Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jonathan R. Latham, Ph.D. He's co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project and editor of Independent Science News. Dr. Latham is also the director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. He holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a Ph.D. in virology. He was subsequently a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Genetics, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, genetics, and genetic engineering. He talks frequently at international events and scientific regulatory conferences on the research conducted by the project. He's written for Truthout, MIT Technology Review, The Guardian, Resilience, and many other magazines and websites. Today we talk about the Poison Papers Project. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Hi there, Derek.
So, what is the Poison Papers Project?
So, well, you know, the project started, at least as far as I'm concerned, in 2015. There's a lady called Carol Van Strum who lives in Oregon, and she is a homesteader. And she was writing an article for a website that I am the editor of, which is called Independent Science News. And Carol was making some strong claims about what she knew about the functioning of the Environmental Protection Agency. And so I, you know, because what we're running is a science website, I said, Carol, you have to back up these claims. Like, you know, something we need to see about these evidence of the existence of secret committees and things like that. You know, she was making very strong claims. And so I said, you know, we have to see these documents in order for you to write it on our website. And we went back and forth over this, and she had nothing online or nothing in any electronic format that she could show me. But she would say things like, oh, this paper is in my barn. I have the evidence. It's in my barn, and so on and so forth. And so I became interested in Carol's barn, and I said, you know, what do you have in your barn? And, you know, long story short, she had about 2.5 tons of paper, which is essentially obtained by her through things like the Freedom of Information Act, through her work with various lawyers who've sued multinational companies over chemical toxicity issues, also from Freedom of Information Act requests to other government agencies like the Bureau of Land Management and the Veterans Administration. And so she had, and also, you know, some of the documents came also from whistleblowers. So she had a whole kind of, you know, collection of information, which started, her story basically was that she and her family had been, they live in Oregon in the, back out in the woods somewhere. And they'd been sprayed by airplanes in the late 1970s. And it turns out that what they were sprayed with was Agent Orange. And her children became sick and some of their animals died. Fish were dying in the river. You know, all kinds of bad things are happening that were clearly associated with these chemical sprayings. And she, all she got from the authorities was reassurances about how, you know, she must be mistaken and contradictions from the governor and, you know, all kinds of local authorities and agencies and even the EPA itself. Everybody was fobbing her off. And so she started on a campaign to basically try to figure out what all these agencies and even the companies knew about the toxicity of these products. So she ended up with basically sort of teasing out all this information from various groups. And so she ended up with this huge pile of documents that was essentially rotting, you know, by the time I spoke to her, was kind of rotting away in her barn. And I said, well, why don't we try to come up with some way that we can, photocopy and scan all these documents and preserve them for posterity, because it sounds, Carol, like you have a lot of stuff that's super interesting. And so we're now in the process of, we've now put it online. We have taken all these documents and we put them on a thing called Document Cloud. and we started a website called the poisonpapers.org. And that is a way for people to access these documents. And so we're now in the process of trying to get journalists, trying to get academics, trying to get various people, you know, anybody really, members of the public interested in making sense of these documents, because there are stories that we know about in here, but there's also, you know, there's also a lot of information that you know, even Carol doesn't always know what is in these documents. So there's a vast amount of that, and hopefully we can talk about some of the specific contents in a minute. But essentially, it's this vast trove of papers that essentially reveal a whole host of incriminating things, not only about the companies and what the companies knew and how it was earlier than what they've always claimed, but also most important and interesting to us is what the EPA knew about all these things, because it's a commonplace story that you know, everybody knows that the companies are perfidious and they hide the information about the lack of safety of their products and so on and so on, put products onto the market which are not safe. But at the same time, the really interesting question in all this is, what did the government know about all these products? Were they completely complicit in all this pollution, this vast amounts of PCBs that are in our waterways and the dioxin that's in the food supply and the pollution of the oceans and the pollution of Superfund sites and so on and so forth? What did they really know about all this, you know, this essential epidemic of pollution?
So before we ask about that, I want to ask a trivial question, which is, mm-hmm. you said 2.5 tons about of paper, mm-hmm. is that what you said?
Yeah.
Can we do just even a rough estimate of how many pages that is? I know it's trivial compared to the other subject.
Yeah,
but.
yeah, we can. It's between 200,000 and 300,000 pages.
Wow. Okay. So let's dive into the real subject then. So what do these pages actually reveal? Can you tell some of the stories that are revealed in there about the relationship between, for example, the EPA and the toxification of the total environment?
So, you know, this has many angles to it, I would say. It's a very complicated story. But essentially, you know, well, towards the end of the interview, maybe we'll get down to what is the sort of order behind the chaos, if you like. But, you know, what I want to help people to understand in the first instance is that, you know, there is a high level of complicity between the agencies and the companies. And so we have, for example, there are documents in there, which is some of the first things that Carol found out, was that the EPA knew quite a bit about the toxicity, for example, of dioxin. Right? So dioxin is a family of chemicals, and I'll call them singular, but many people call them plural. But basically, it's a family of chemicals that are byproducts of the production process of chlorinated hydrocarbons. So that, for example, pretty much any, you know, many people think that pretty much any chlorinated hydrocarbon will have some proportion of dioxin present in the manufacturing process. And there are many chemicals, for example, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, whose structure is very similar to dioxins. Basically, there's two benzene rings, and then they're basically joined together, and then they're decorated with chlorine molecule. So this is kind of like an endpoint structure of the chemical reaction process, and essentially, the longer and hotter you run those reactions, the more likely you are to get to these endpoints with the double ring structures all covered in chlorine molecule that are essentially incredibly toxic to people. So they are you know, something like, depending on the process, down to about a couple of parts per trillion can be hazardous to the development of animals. So these are things for which there's no safe dose, and for which essentially any dose is going to give you harm. And not all of this was known in the 1970s, but they knew that extremely small quantities could harm people. And the chemical industry has actually known this for a very long time, because they're, in a sense, ubiquitous of the as products of chlorinated hydrocarbon chemistry. The chemical industry has known for a long time that there were certain chemical processes that caused workers at factories to become sick. And so the workers would get spots on them, and they would often have things like immune problems. Later in life, dioxins give cancer and more kind of sort of standard toxicological consequences. But the immediate consequence, the kind of consequence that you're going to notice as part of your workforce evaluations or just wandering around the site, will be things like liver toxicity and these spots. And the company workers, for example, one of the things that's interesting about the papers is they document how in the 1960s, Dow Chemical in Midland, Michigan, they were basically manufacturing Agent Orange there. Okay, so you imagine that, you know, this is a chemical that's caused, you know, millions of birth defects around the world. And they were producing it on that site in huge quantities. And the thing that's most dangerous about Agent Orange is these dioxin contaminants. The chemicals themselves are not good, and they will give you serious illnesses all on their own. But dioxins are, you know, probably several orders of magnitude more toxic than the chemicals themselves. So what the chemical company found was that their workers were basically getting, you know, in certain parts of the factory certain parts of the plants where they were making these ring structures were becoming, you know, were getting these sort of acne type, you know, terrible, you know, really bad acne spots. And so they started talking to other companies about what was going on here. And there was a sort of, you know, there were always certain people in all these companies who knew quite a bit about the toxicological history of these things. Like new people, you know, people always cycling through these companies, but they knew back to even to the 19th century that people have been reporting these kinds of symptoms from the use of chlorinated hydrocarbon. And between them, they kind of were in discussions, it turns out. They were exchanging letters with each other about chemical accidents, for example, in which people have been exposed. And especially you got these problems when chemical accidents happen. Basically, the temperature runs too high. The thing that, you know, your vat explodes or whatever. Lots of people get contaminated, and you contaminate a large area, you know, in and around the plant, for example. But essentially, what's happening in those chemical explosions is the reactions are running ahead of the production of the thing that you want, and they're producing dioxins. So at the same time as you're having this accident, you get these dioxins produced in particularly high quantities. So they were exchanging information, firstly about the nature of their accidents, secondly about the nature of the illnesses that the workers were suffering from. But also what they knew was that the workers were suffering from similar illnesses even when as a result of normal production processes, right? So you know, companies are not stupid, right? They can see perfectly well. You know, they may pretend that they don't know all kinds of stuff, but they had methods of figuring things out. So for example, after one of their accidents, Bayer, I think it was, put one of the German companies, either BASF or Bayer, they basically put animals into the factory where the workers were, right? And they put animals into the factory where the workers were, and the animals were dead after 24 hours. And so they knew that this was a highly toxic byproduct that had come out of these experiments. And they didn't necessarily tell their workers this, but they understood, you know, this information was being shared at the higher levels of management. But it's also the case that workers in these factories also knew more than the management really wanted them to. Because in Dow's Michigan plant, when they were making Agent Orange, they pretty much had a worker revolt. Because what was going on at the factory was that the workers were developing this acne. And the workers knew, firstly, you weren't supposed to have acne. Secondly, that the acne was associated with all kinds of other illnesses, like immune problems and liver problems and essentially muscle fatigue and all kinds of, you know, not nice things that were happening to these workers. And so there were workers having to be taken off and moved to different parts of the factory. There were workers talking to each other about how they were becoming sick. The company was putting, was having to listen to worker demands about their concerns about the product and working in these particular buildings where they were making these involved in these particular processes. And so the companies, they kind of go through Dow in this particular case, went through this whole process of, you know, we'll put a doctor in the plant and then we'll try to keep workers in there for the minimal amount of time. We'll try to, you know, reduce all the leaks and various things. And they end up kind of basically walling off that whole section of the plant and having people not go in there very often. But essentially, there's a whole report that's written by Dow Chemicals about firstly their discussions with all the other companies, and secondly about all this basically toxicological consequences that they were sort of figuring out came from a small contaminant that was in their product. And so this is, you know, this predates the Vietnam War by 10 years, and their public admissions and public understanding of the toxicity of 2,4-D and Agent Orange and so forth by quite a long time. You know, there are various understandings of problems that go back before the Second World War, for example, and then this kind of culminates into this, you know, kind of industry understanding in which the big companies are trying to educate the small companies into you're making this product, but you don't have this long history of understanding that they're byproducts in here and problematic issues that you need to deal with. And so they're all kind of exchanging letters among each other and having meetings and calling meetings. And are we going to tell the EPA? Are we going to tell the this is even before the EPA existed, right? Are we going to tell the government and so on and so forth? So all this narrative kind of is contained within these papers. And so that's one of the stories, for example.
So just so we're really clear, the one of the horrors of this is that at the same time that they are openly discussing among themselves, what do we do about this or that problem, they are publicly insisting that there is no problem. Is that part of the atrocity?
So there's press release from the Dow head of Dow Chemical, for example, saying they don't know of any problems with Agent Orange and so forth. Yeah.
And in these hundreds of thousands of pages, who else are some of the actors that don't come across well? So you've talked about Dow, BASF, maybe Bayer, the EPA. So who else are some of the, and also what are a couple other of the stories that are told that people really should know about?
Well, you know that, I mean, the people who come out of this in some sense is worse in that, you know, they have a reasonable public image is the EPA, right? So EPA, for example, this is kind of an ulcer. Some of your readers might have heard of a lab called Industrial Biotest Labs, and they were a chemical testing company. And they essentially, you know, we have a system in this country where, it's sort of presumed that an independent lab will do the actual experiments on the animals to look at the toxicological consequences of a company's product. And the idea is that this chemical, the testing lab, is independent of the manufacturer. So, but this independence is entirely, I would say entirely fictitious, because the manufacturers are, they're basically repeated customers of these independent chemical testing labs. So they, you know, if, and the companies, the manufacturers will also shop around. You know, imagine there are 10 labs basically doing independent testing, quote unquote independent testing. They will basically go to these labs and they will say, they will notice that, you know, an honest lab is coming back with all kinds of results about, you know, there's carcinogenicity, there's fetal toxicity, there's, you know, all kinds of stuff. And there are some labs that are not giving them that information. That for whatever reason, they're basically giving their products a clean bill of health. So you can easily imagine there's a huge incentive for these quote-unquote independent testing labs to basically deliver fraudulent results. It stands to reason. And the essentially, what happened in the case of industrial biotest labs is they grew to become the largest independent chemical testing lab in the country. And in the 1976, a research senior scientist from FDA discovered that the industrial biotest labs was basically submitting fraudulent data. And he went to the labs. And you know, it only took him 5 minutes of looking around to work out that this lab was not keeping its animals right. It was not following the protocols. It wasn't doing anything right. And the people at the lab ended up calling the police on this FDA researcher, who basically taken it upon himself to go and visit this lab. And so this became public, and it became an international scandal. It was reported a little bit in the papers, but the story that was reported in the papers is that essentially that EPA had discovered that this chemical testing lab was responsible for about 30 or 40% of all chemical testing done in the country at the time. And it was, so there were many, many public products. You know, there are many, many products like glyphosate, like atrazine, like chlorpyrifos, like 2,4-D, many of which have been through the industrial biotest system. And these, and EPA, basically, you know, they did a joint investigation along with the FDA. And, but because most of the chemicals were in question were pesticides, EPA ended up leading this, along with, they also had a collaboration with the Health Protection Board of Canada. And essentially, what EPA should have done, if EPA was honest, is they would have said, we will basically, to tell the public, as soon as they knew, firstly, what chemicals had been tested by industrial biotest labs. Because, you know, what the public, what each individual person needs to know is, has the chemical that I want to put on my lawn or my pet or my food or whatever it is, has that been through basically a fraudulent independent chemical testing process? But EPA concealed that information. And they concealed that information because otherwise people would make decisions about what products to buy, and that would be a problem for the chemical industry. You know, many companies had, most of their products had been through this IBT system. So the official story is that EPA did a very long and complicated investigation into what was fraudulent and what was not fraudulent at IBT, and then they basically sorted the sheep from the goats, and what was, you know, the necessary corrections were made to the system. You know, new tests were done and so on and so forth. But that isn't what actually happened at all. What happened is that EPA realized straight away that basically none of the research at industrial biotest labs was honest. It was probably all fraudulent. They could not hardly find any experiments that hadn't been misreported, that hadn't been basically falsified signatures. There were the EPA ended up, for example, accepting data, even after this fraud was totally exposed, at least internally to EPA, they ended up accepting data which the company itself refused, the company employees themselves refused to sign, right? So the company employees themselves refused to sign the data. That means that they have no idea whether it's true or not, right? They are totally have no confidence in that, and they're not going to stand behind it. But basically, EPA, basically in the document, tells the chemical industry how we're basically accepting data from this company that we know to be fraudulent, that they even are too honest to sign, right? So the EPA is basically vouching for chemical safety testing data that the company will not vouch for. So they, you know, they've, and in that process, becoming party to the fraud. And this was only part of the issue. So basically, you know, a huge proportion of the chemicals being used by the public in the U.S. have been fraudulently reported. They knew this. But instead of telling people, they basically made up this idea that they were doing a complicated investigation. And then they did kind of go through this kind of sort of faux investigation. But they knew the whole time that it was all fraudulent. And the purpose of this investigation was therefore to buy time for the companies so that they could put their chemicals through a new set of tests, which essentially, it took them 5 or 6 years to do this investigation, but that basically allowed the companies to do a whole set of new tests and basically kept the public in the dark to the fact that these chemicals, the chemicals they were using all over, were basically, were subject to fraudulent reporting. So the EPA basically was using its powers of investigation to essentially provide cover for the companies to be able to basically keep their products on the market.
I remember reading somewhere that some overwhelming percentage of the chemicals that are used in modern society have not, in fact, been tested for, have not even been tested at all. And so what it seems you're suggesting is that, or what these papers are suggesting, is that, yes, there are a high percentage that have not been tested, and in addition, many of those that have been tested, the tests are, the tests are fraudulent. The tests are at best deeply flawed.
Yeah, I mean, I would just simply say fraudulent. I mean, it's a complicated situation because it's true that many things are on the market that have never really been through any kind of testing at all. But the questions that the papers cover are the things that have been through this testing process. And what the papers show is that this testing process in many, many ways is dysfunctional. You know, you have, for example, there is evidence that other companies and other products were also submitting fraudulent tests to the EPA. But the EPA never did anything about these at all, right? They just would take data that clearly may little or no sense, or the companies, for example, would say no pathologist was on duty. You know, it would say in the application no pathologist was on duty at the time that this chemical, at the time that we did the autopsies on the animals that we did use for these tests. So basically, what they're saying is that they're not actually examining the animals for tumors, for example. You know, you do a carcinogenicity test, the only way that you can ascertain whether these animals at the time of death have, the treated groups have more tumors than the non-treated groups is basically you take sections, and you look at them under a microscope and you see lumps of various sizes and then you make some professional analysis of what those lumps mean and what kind of tumor is in that animal. And basically what the companies are saying is what the independent labs are basically saying is, you know, we went through the process, but no one actually, with any professional experience, actually examined the slide, right? So this is just fraud of a slightly different kind. Do you know what I mean? But so you have this kind of, you know, all these different levels of incompetence and uselessness and essentially deception going on through the whole process. And so, you know, the EPA, for example, is paying lip service to the law by doing the chemical testing, by having it done by an independent company and so on and so forth. But actually, they're not respecting the scientific process in the least. And so you have a situation, in which all the way through the chemical testing process. So basically the data is being submitted to the EPA. Then EPA is looking at this data and they're basically accepting it at face value, even though at face value, you know, any rational person would say at face value, this data is worthless. You know, there are missing experiments, for example. You know, it's one of the things I'm writing up at the moment. They're examining a chemical application. In this case, the chemical is called permethrin. People use permethrin all the time. And permethrin was approved by the EPA in 1982, I think. Yes, it was 1982. EPA had data for permethrin that basically showed, in all different kinds of ways that permethrin was a carcinogen. And they took this data and they basically, you know, at face value, there's a huge excess of tumors in the permethrin data. But what EPA would do, they would take that data and they would submit it to various kinds of analysis in which they would basically come up with ways, basically spend, you know, 2 or 3 years analyzing this chemical. And they basically, what they're essentially doing is coming up with different ways to discount the elevated incidences of cancer in all these different tissues and in all these different types of experiments. So you've got, you know, firstly, is probably what's even being submitted to them is a way underestimate of the amount of cancer in the treated animal. But they ignore all that possibility. And I would say probability, given there would be good reasons why somebody didn't submit a certain animal or a certain set of tissues or a certain whatever to the analysis, which is, you know, so basically the way that, let me backtrack a little bit. The way these tests are supposed to be done is before you even start, the company who does the test submits a protocol. They basically say, we're going to do it this way. And so when it finally comes to the analysis and it's sent into EPA, it hasn't been done that way at all. You know, they've ignored, huge amounts of organs. They've failed to analyze certain animals and so on and so forth. And the obvious question, if you're an evaluator at the EPA, is to say, well, why didn't you look at these animals? Was it because they had cancer? Was it because they died before they should have? Was it because they had some other chronic, illness and so on and so forth? But EPA never asked these questions. They would just take the data and then they would do statistics as pretending, in a sense, that they had all the data for the experiments. Because as soon as you start to do statistics and you've got missing animals, you don't know whether those missing animals should go in the, you know, they died for some important reason, or maybe the company just forgot to analyze them, in which case they're just, you know, they were essentially unharmed by the treatment. The EPA has no idea which one of those two things is true. But, so essentially they're making up statistics as they go along in order to basically, what it appears to be is to give this chemical a clean bill of health. So they go through this process of taking the submitted data, and then when it shows that there are, excesses of tumors in the treated groups, they will do things like they will take those tumors and they will sort of decide, are these tumors, they're actually two different kinds of tumors. And because the set of tumors that's elevated by this chemical is now considered to be two kinds of tumors, it's no longer statistically significant as a result. Or the tumors are considered to be rare, or they're put into another group. They're essentially massaging the data, if you like, in order to give this chemical a clean bill of health. And so they've gone through this process of essentially whitewashing this chemical. So what the treated, you know, what the raw data suggests is this huge elevation of tumors in the treated groups. And what the final report of the EPA is basically to say there's no difference between the treated and untreated groups because we discounted these tumors for that reason, and these tumors for that reason, and these tumors for that reason, and these ones for another reason, and so on and so forth, and until eventually the thing gets a clean bill of health. But this has taken 2 or 3 years of analysis to do. It's happened across different departments of EPA. So, you know, the people who do the initial evaluation are different from the people who do the intermediary evaluation, who are different from the people who have put together into some ad hoc committee, and then they're different from the group that actually pulls the whole thing together, and then that report is submitted to another branch of EPA, so on and so forth. So, like, there's this kind of system, a sort of systemic failure in which the people in each group are only committing relatively minor scientific sins. But when you add them all up, what happens is that the, you know, if each group of scientists who get to look at the data basically kind of do a little bit of massaging each, by the time they've all done a little bit of massaging each, the problem basically goes away. And so the submission, the original data submitted, there's no relation to the final report that EPA essentially makes part of the public record and says, you know, based on this data, we don't find any problems with this chemical, and therefore we're going to approve it with this allowable daily intake level. So this is the kind of, what's really interesting, firstly, is the fact that EPA is doing all this massaging of the data. But then the second thing is to ask the question, why are they doing this, right? Why as an agency would you fail to carry out your mission to protect the public? Like, what's in it for you? And I'm going to save you asking me the question because I can tell you what's in it for them. You know, lots of people focus on the revolving door and influences of industry and so forth on the EPA. But what we think is going on is something somewhat different from that. What we think is going on is that you have to imagine you're a junior person who works for the EPA, and you notice that there's an obvious excess of tumors in the treated groups. And you have to pass that. Basically, what's going to happen is you're a junior person. You're going to have to pass on to your boss and some information, which is basically going to destroy the probability of it being approved of some, you know, fancy new product of a very large international corporation like Monsanto or BASF or ICI or whoever it is. And your boss is not going to thank you for passing him or her that piece of information, because they're going to have to pass it to their boss, and their boss is not going to thank them for having that piece of information, and so on and so forth. And this goes all the way to the top of EPA. So there's an incentive which is built into the system, which basically says we don't want to hear any problem about chemicals that you may find. And the reason for this system is that, you know, at the end of the day, the head of the EPA, you know, the equivalent to Scott Pruitt, is basically, you know, imagine Scott Pruitt loves the environment and really wants to protect the planet and so on and so forth. He is going to basically say, look, let me just remind you that he's appointed by the president. He is basically going to have to take this piece of information, ultimately, if it pans out, to the president and say, Mr. President, we're going to have to ban this chemical, and there's going to be some complaints from this, you know, multinational chemical corporation, but this is a very important thing to do. And so he's going to basically have to make that case to the president. And the president is, you know, knowing most presidents of the United States, is going to say no, right? We're not doing that. You're not going to be able to do that. So Scott Pruitt knows this, the equivalent of his Scott Pruitt's deputy knows this. The deputy of the deputy knows this. The deputy, deputy, deputy knows this. Everybody in the EPA knows this, all the way from the bottom. So the only permissible solution to that problem is to bury the data, right? So what you see in these papers is the perfect example of that. So at each level of the process, people are basically burying the data so that everything that goes through the agency ultimately ends up with a clean bill of health, no matter how it started. And so that is our thesis about how these agencies function, right? Basically, it's a simplified, you know, very complex version, rather, of the idea that bad news doesn't travel. Right? You cannot pass really bad news up to the top of the agency because apart from anything, it disturbs people. You know, if you subtly remove, you know, kind of greenwash all these chemicals, it basically allows the people who work for the agency to retain the idea that they are actually protectors of the environment, right? Because the people who work at EPA, that I don't believe in the idea of good and bad people. For the most part, there are just people who want to keep their jobs and don't, you know, they're not intellectually together enough and they're not smart enough and they're not quite honest enough to pass the whole truth up through the system. So what they do is they kind of massage it at every stage of the process. But at the same time, they feel like they're passing on what is the accurate piece of information. But essentially what the agency does is develop all these mythologies about certain, the way you square the circle is you develop within the agencies all these sort of systems of arguments. For example, one argument would be, if this chemical, permethrin, causes an excess of tumors in male rats, but doesn't cause an excess of tumors in female rats, therefore, there must be something wrong with the data. And what's wrong with the data is the excess in the male rats, right? What's not wrong with the data is the normal number of tumors in the female rat. And so everybody says, oh, well, it's not consistent, right? It's not, it's obviously an invalid result. And so the agency has circulated within its system all these totally unscientific, arguments, but they're deployed whenever necessary to do this greenwashing process, right? To do this kind of health washing process. And so that is the fundamental underlying dynamic under which these organizations function. Because, and the essential reason is because the president is not prepared to actually do anything for the environment at the expense of political donors or the economy or however they perceive their interest to be, that essentially this system has to be in place. And people who don't agree with it essentially become whistleblowers or they say nothing.
Well, thank you for that really great analysis. And as you were saying all that, I was thinking that we could do similar analyses for the way the Forest Service works with getting out the cut in terms of timber production and ignoring the effects of it. We could talk about that with the Deepwater Horizon or any other oil things or the approval of permits for various gas leases. This seems to be a horrifying trajectory of permitting under this entire permitting system. Having said that, we have about 5 minutes left and I have a couple questions I want to ask him. I just want to say first off that I think everything you're saying is really horrifying, and that leads to a question before the wrap-up question. The question is, What has been the response by the mainstream, by mainstream or corporate journalism to, this, all of these various, analyses and smoking guns that you're providing?
You know, the, we have tried to share these stories and, you know, Sharon Lerner did a story about it in The Intercept. The Guardian did a story about PCBs. I'm trying to think who else, mostly, you know, smaller media have done some bits and bobs. But, you know, the sense, the overwhelming sense that you get is that the mainstream media does not want to cover any of these issues. You know, they have, you know, they basically, they just find reasons why they can't, somehow cannot cover the stories that you have. You know, I'm happy to see, you know, we've sent press releases and we've sent information out to these people. And these people know that we have a valid set of documents that we could, you know, that could shed light, huge amounts of light on the kinds of things that they claim to be interested in. Like Agent Orange or, you know, herbicide toxicity and so on and so forth. We have all kinds of stories. But these investigative, in quotes, journalists do not pick up the phone, right? They don't come to us and ask us, you know, oh, do you have an interesting story about this or that or the other? And occasionally they do, right? You know, 1 in 100 or so of these journalists will. And we will tell them a story that, you know, to me would make the most interesting story of the entire year. And they don't get back to you. Right? So, you know, they perceive limits on what they can do. You know, maybe this is no surprise to you, but, you know, the kind of obviousness of it all is slightly startling, I would say. You know, why do they not come and find us? Why do they not talk to us and try to find out more and go and find the sources? And the answer is that they're posturing as journalists is kind of the way that I would argue it.
Well, it seems in many ways the same dynamic is playing out as the one you're talking about. They it's like you said, bad news doesn't travel, and there are limits. So, but really, we only have a couple minutes left, and all of the information that you've given is, and analysis you've given is so important. And what exactly, or generally, do you want people to do with this information? So, somebody is listening to this, and they live in Oklahoma, and they are really moved by this. What do you want them to do now?
I mean, the bottom line is, you know, don't expose yourself and your family to these chemicals. You know, minimize your exposure. I mean, what we do in our house, you know, I have to use a computer for my work, but, you know, we try to buy items made of glass or steel or wood or, you know, things that give us a very limited exposure to the kinds of chemicals. You know, we have wood floors or, you know, we really try our best to limit our exposure. Because the bottom line is you're not, I mean, we could do another interview about how even with the best will in the world, right, even if we had the best EPA and they were trying their hardest and whatever, these still would have basically no guarantees. You know, this is a complicated argument that I'd be very happy to make on your show. But essentially, there is no way of testing these chemicals, right, because a chemical has to be safe for your immune system. It has to be safe for your reproductive system. It has to be safe for your neurological system. It has to be safe for your liver. It has to be safe for your heart. It has to be safe for all these different things. And it basically, when you test a chemical, you have to, you can only test it for a specific minority of potential toxicological endpoints. And so essentially, even if it was true that EPA was doing a good job, you can on logical grounds demonstrate that we're still not protected anyway. We still would not be protected anyway. But the basic line is, bottom line is, treat these chemicals as if they've never been tested on any animal or in any meaningful way. They're essentially unknown toxicological hazards. And you will purge your household of these these products to the extent you can.
Well, we are really running out of time, but there is a question I just have to ask, which is, and maybe we can save this for another interview, is what are the social implications? You just talked right there about the personal implications. Get, mm-hmm. you know, bisphenol A out of your life. But what are the social mm-hmm. implications of government permitting processes that facilitate the toxification of
yeah.
citizens
yeah.
and the environment?
Yeah. Well, many of our products can be made perfectly well with, you know, natural products, right? You know, clothes and houses and so forth. These things can be made. And it comes down to the economy, right? The government attempting to extract taxes from the economy because they want the economy, you know, they want the economy to go faster and faster so they can extract taxes for their war machine. This is basically what is going on here. So they have an incentive, they have a built-in incentive to approve all these things. So that is the kind of bottom line for me.
Well, thank you so much for your work and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jonathan R. Latham, PhD. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.